It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Central Time, you've probably heard of the famous fossil Lucy, our 3.2 million year old ancestor. But there are a lot of new fossils found in just the last few years that are challenging our idea of where we came from and how our species evolved. We'll find out more with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. First, a mine proposed for Michigan's Upper Peninsula is reigniting the debate over potential economic benefits and environmental costs that came up in the discussion over an iron ore mine proposed for northern Wisconsin. The new proposal would be a few hundred feet from the state border with Wisconsin. The project would be an open-pit mine to extract gold, zinc, copper, and silver along the Menominee River. Lee Bergquist covered this for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's with us now to talk about the details. Lee, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob.
Well, first, give us the outlines of this mining proposal and the company behind it.
Well, the company behind it is Aquila Resources. It's a Toronto-based company. And it has been looking at Wisconsin and the UP, where this project is, for some time. It actually, I did not report this in the last story, but they have they've got their eye on a couple of sites in central Wisconsin for gold as well, but that's not as active as this project here. Aquila, several years ago, teamed up with another company named Hud Bay Mineral Resources, and they were going to do this project on the Menominee River, and then Hud Bay backed out and decided it wanted to put its capital elsewhere. There was a period of time where there was no action, and then in late November, the company Aquila decided it was going to move forward on its own and handed in an application to Michigan authorities, and that's where we're at now.
Let's talk about some of the arguments for and against this mine. There's been some research into economic benefits, first of all. What has been said about the potential for this mine?
Well, the company used University of Minnesota Duluth to do some economic work for them, they hired the University of Minnesota Duluth to do an economic analysis, and the university has done this work before for other projects. I remember reading about some up on the Iron Range in northern Minnesota, so they are they've certainly done this kind of work before. Almost every time that these research projects are trotted out like this, the critics will say that the environmental aspects are either underplayed or ignored, and that you end up having people just pointing fingers at each other. But nonetheless, UMD says that the project would generate $20 million in new tax revenue for for federal, state, and local governments each year, and that in a royalty system that Michigan uses, that there would be about $16.5 million in royalties from the minerals that would flow to state government in Michigan.
And on the employment side of things, any thought that the benefits would spread across the Wisconsin border?
Yeah. According to the UMD folks, they looked at this project on a four-county basis, three counties in the UP, and then one county in Wisconsin, Marinette County, and that there would be economic benefit accruing to Marinette County as well. And in their analysis, they estimated about 1,300 construction jobs and about 450 new jobs, both at the mine and in the surrounding area.
Talking to Lee Bergquist from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a proposal for a mine to extract gold, zinc, copper, and silver at a site just a few hundred feet, I think it is, from the Wisconsin border up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Lee, let's talk about the environmental side of this. Now, what kind of concerns are being raised about a project like this and where it is?
Well, I mean, any time there is a proposal for a mine in Wisconsin or in the UP, there is inevitably an environmental fight. In this case, the mine, the pit of the mine would be as close as 150 feet from the shore of the river. And so the issue there is, you know, can that mine be managed correctly so that there isn't runoff that goes into the lake, or pardon me, into the Menominee River? As it's engineered, all the wastewater would be treated in a wastewater treatment plant. The runoff, in theory, there would be nothing should be released into that river. But whether that happens, whether there's an accident, unforeseen circumstances, you know, that's what opponents are raising already.
Another concern usually with mining projects is they don't last forever. They tap out the easily accessible product and then move on. And so what happens afterward, remediation afterward? What is the company saying about that? What are environmentalists saying about that?
Yeah, what the company is saying is that it would, you would have a pit that would be a couple hundred feet deep, and when it's done, they would fill it up and cover it over, and and the land would go back to what it once was, is simply put. Now that would be different than if you remember the Gogebic mine up in northern Wisconsin. They were going to leave that pit alone, and they were going to fill it up with water, or it was going to fill up with rainwater or with groundwater and turn it into a lake. And that's also the case of another mine that was constructed near Black River Falls. They did not cover that mine over. It filled up with groundwater and it became Lake Wazee, which is the largest, the deepest lake in the inland Wisconsin.
Now, another angle on that GTAC mine proposal, now apparently not going to happen, was the tribal element, tribal concerns about impacts on their land, their culture. Is that something that's likely to be an issue with this new proposal in the UP of Michigan?
Yeah, you bet. It will be. In this case, it may be a little slight. I'm sure the Menominee tribe, which is based in Kashina, is concerned about this. That mouth of that river is where their early settlements were. The whole corridor of the river is an area that they claim as a long ancestral lands. And they're concerned about artifacts and a lot of cultural resources that may be damaged at this mine, in addition to the environmental concerns. Whereas the Bad River, much of the argument you heard from them was that that the belief that the iron ore mine that Gogebic was going to construct would taint both groundwater and surface water that would flow through their reservation downstream close to Lake Superior.
Now, last week, I understand, was the first public hearing about this project. Do we know what was brought up there? Was there an even amount of pro and con speaking out there?
Well, and this is an example where I have to rely on what I heard from some people I talked to and from the local paper up there. I did not attend that hearing, but from my reading of it, it was fairly evenly split between supporters and detractors of the project. And there was a couple of hundred people that met at Stevenson, Michigan, and it was fairly evenly split on both sides of the issue.
As we wrap up, Lee, do you expect this to be a battle similar to what we've seen here in northern Wisconsin with GTAC and other mining proposals, only on the Michigan side of the border now?
I do, with a couple of caveats. One, you don't have legislation that the mine company is seeking and almost demanding from a legislature, in that case, Michigan's legislature. And in this case, there have been, under Michigan's mining laws, there is another mine that was recently approved up farther to the north in the UP, and so there is a little bit more familiarity with this, and so possibly because of this, there might be there definitely will be some a lot of talk about this, but it might be somewhat muted for those factors.
Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Lee Bergquist, reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he covers environmental issues. He's with us to talk about the implications for Wisconsin of an open pit mine being proposed for Michigan's Upper Peninsula, very near the border. When asked who our oldest ancestor is, you might say Lucy, the famous 3.2 million-year-old fossil found in East Africa. For decades, paleoanthropologists thought the origin of our species was in that region, but recent fossil findings in South Africa are inspiring scientists to think humanity's homeland is moving south. Gemma Tarlak's here to break down the story for us. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about some of the coolest science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, always good to be with you, Rob.
Before we get to the fossils, Gemma, I understand this is one of your favorite David Bowie songs, 5 years.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on the news today and Bowie's music?
Well, you know, it broke my heart, and I know some of my baby boomer friends will take issue with this, but David Bowie, he was my Beatles. He was my Rolling Stones. So it's very sad, and, you know, a lot of the times I find this fascinating relevance in his music to what I cover in science.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always thought of 5 years. If you know the song, it's about finding out that we've got 5 years left because we've broken the earth and it's dying. And I always associate that song the past several years with climate change. You know, just this, yep, you did it. You broke the world. Congratulations. So it's sad in that way, but I always found his music so positive, so tremendously positive and creative. And yeah, it's kind of a downer day for me, so.
It is, but on the upside, he, I think, always had us looking outward and upward, and that'll take us into what we really have you here to talk about today, looking, digging deeper into our origins as humans. And now South Africa is the hot spot for finding hominin fossils, our closest ancestors through history. And that wasn't, people didn't think we were going to find them there in South Africa.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Some of the earliest fossil finds in the early 20th century were actually in South Africa. And that was great. Australopithecus africanus was found there, and that was a big deal. And then things really, in about the middle of the 20th century, things quieted down, and everybody started looking at Eastern Africa. That's where Lucy was found. That's where a lot of other fossils were found as well. And people just started to think, we're finding all these fossils in East Africa. This must be really where our ancestors originated, where we evolved. And so the spotlight really kind of focused on East Africa for decades, to the point where, you know, in the 1990s, a leading paleoanthropologist actually said, there's no point in even looking in South Africa. Everything that's there to find, we've already found. And, wow, he really had to eat those words, because ever since then, we have been making incredible discoveries. Of course, we talked about Homo naledi on a previous show, a previous spot with you guys, and that was a huge find from last year. A whole new member of the Homo genus, very exciting. But there are a lot of other finds, including Littlefoot. Littlefoot, we thought, was about 2 million years old. It's this wonderfully, wonderfully preserved hominid fossil. But it turns out Littlefoot is 3.67 years old from South Africa.
So he's older than Lucy.
Older. Yeah, older than Lucy by almost half a million years. And such rich finds are coming out where no one even thought to look. Now that they're looking, they're finding them.
And Gemma, before we climb further up the family tree, I want to talk about how we're finding these finds that at least some people thought weren't there to find. Do we get better at looking? Do we start looking in different areas in South Africa? What happened?
Well, you know, fossils throughout Africa, actually throughout the world, it's really a matter of climate and geography. There are some places where you will not find any fossils just because it's very humid and there's no possibility of preservation. South Africa, though, it's different than East Africa, but in South Africa there are all these cave systems. There are just miles and miles and miles of cave systems, some of them very difficult to reach and very difficult to explore. There are some theories, for example, that a lot of these early hominids were basically prey for some of the large cats that were roaming around, and the cats would, you know, kill the hominin, drag him up the tree, and then, you know, eat them in the tree, and the bones would fall and land in these crevices that feed into these cave systems. That's one theory about why we might be finding all these fossils, but they're all in these cave systems that are often we don't even know about, and then some amateur spelunker stumbles upon a new chamber and finds, wow, it's full of bones.
Well, and yeah, Homo naledi, right? That was the story. This is really hard to get to. They had to advertise for really tiny, petite archaeologists to crawl in and get to these things. And there were a lot of them there. This wasn't just a big cat dropping them out of a tree.
Right, and that's the really fascinating thing about Homo naledi, is that this cave, this particular spot where they found them, it was never open to the ground above. It's always been a chamber accessed through a series of very, very narrow passages, and some of them almost completely vertical. But what the amazing thing about Homo naledi is, really, they found more than 1,500 fossils from at least 15 different individuals. And the number of fossils they found, combined with the fact that there was no easy way to get those fossils there, that's really what has led researchers to say that they believe they were deliberately placed there, deliberately sort of buried there, if you will, which would be a huge finding, because we thought that behavior was pretty much only us and the Neanderthals were capable of actually burying our dead.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha, about an explosion, really, in recent years of attention to fossils from South Africa changing our human family tree, where we came from, some of our closest ancestors. And Gemma, yeah, I mean, I had textbooks throughout the years. They showed Homo habilis, Homo erectus, Australopithecines over here. Are we reaching for the erasers here and scrambling to figure out who fits where in this puzzle?
Absolutely. And you know, if you talk to the paleoanthropologists, they can't agree, and sometimes they don't even agree with themselves. I remember speaking with one last year about some other finds in Europe, and he was contradicting himself during the interview. And he said, you know, I'm kind of changing my mind as I go along, just because we're really stumbling on more and more finds that challenge what we thought we knew, whether it be about location, where a species arose and evolved first, or whether it's about, for example, the use of fire. One of the things our writer covers in our story about South African finds is the site of the Wonderwork Cave. They haven't found any fossils there yet, but they're finding evidence that fires were set deliberately, controlled fires, and that is a hallmark of advanced hominin behavior. You know, there are a lot of theories that having the use of fire allowed us to cook our food, that made the proteins more accessible and gave us bigger brains. So there are all these kind of chain reaction theories, and we're just kind of like uncovering the very first links in those chains. It's fascinating.
We've mentioned Homo naledi and Littlefoot. Who else have we met in South Africa?
Well, there's a ton of them, but we have to talk for a little bit about caribou. He is a member of the Australopithecus sediba species, and they, you know, were found in South Africa. That's the only place they've been found so far, about 2 million years old. Several individuals have been found, but caribou, which was a young male of the species, he's kind of held up as the base example. And they're fascinating because they're 2 million years old, but they have this really intriguing mix of very old features and newer features, you know, in terms of having a modern torso and limb proportions, but a pelvis that's more like a chimpanzee. So it's kind of, not only are we finding these new individuals, but they're made up of traits and features that we didn't expect to see combined with each other. So it's really making everyone kind of scratch their heads and rethink our family tree.
How do we figure out who's grandpa and who's a cousin of all these? Who's a branch that led to us and who's a branch that led nowhere, that eventually died out?
That is the $26,000 question, at least, maybe more than that. That is the Powerball question. It's a challenge because, you know, unfortunately, our techniques are not advanced enough to be able to really retrieve and read the DNA when we're talking millions of years. They're working on that, and I personally think in our lifetimes, we will find it possible to sequence the DNA from, you know, these very early ancestors of ours. But they have to look at things like the way specific traits evolved. You know, it's not like all of a sudden a species has a pelvis that's shaped in a certain way. These things evolve usually very slowly over time, and they can kind of tell that by comparing one to the other. But there are a lot of questions still out there.
Gemma, this takes me back to a theme, and I apologize. I think I keep saying this every time I talk to you, but this tells us, again, science isn't done yet. It's not that textbook over there on the wall. It's happening now.
Well, you know, a lot of researchers I talk to, when I point out, like, well, they're going to have to rewrite the history books on this one, a lot of researchers I talk to say science is not about the answers, it's about the questions. And, you know, it's always about, what do you know? Can you prove how you know it, and what happens if someone tries to disprove it. You know, that's how science advances, by questioning everything that has gone before. So I think this is a really fun time, actually, to be in this field of science, because it's changing and refining itself so quickly.
Very briefly, Gemma, what is the next big question on these South African fossils?
Oh, the next big question has to be, how old is Homo naledi? We found all these fossils. Well, not we, but, you know, the researchers found, I wish I'd been on or not, but the researchers found all these fantastic fossils. However, because there's no associated material that they can use to date it, they have to try some other more advanced techniques that take longer to actually date the material. That's going to really tell us everything about where Homo naledi fits in our family tree.
Well, we'll talk about that with you, Gemma, when they figure that out. Thanks a lot, as always, for being with us.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She was with us to talk about how hominin fossils in South Africa are shaping up the human origin story. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. We're looking for your David Bowie memories and favorite songs. Share them with us over on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll share some of those on the air through the show today. First, primary voting kicks off next month in the race for president. Voters will weigh their options, head to the polls, or caucuses, and make their choices for their party's standard bearer in November. Just one problem, according to our next guest, they will be very uninformed about vital issues in the race and in American politics, woefully uninformed. Not just the people you disagree with, all of them. Even when the time comes, you and me. Arthur Lupia joins us now from the studios of WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's a professor of political science at the University of Michigan and author of the new book, Uninformed, Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. Arthur, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, you write that there are two groups of people in the United States. I'm going to quote here. One group understands that they are almost completely ignorant of almost every detail of almost every law and policy under which they live. The other group is delusional about how much they know. So why are we all, and you include yourself in this, so ignorant about this crucial stuff?
Well, you know, part of it is there's just so many laws. Like, for example, the U.S. Congress, even last year, passed over 200 laws. You know, I keep track of this stuff like a lot of people do, but I can't name more than four or five. And while I'll admit to have reading the Affordable Care Act cover to cover, you know, most laws are really long and hard to read. And moreover, a lot of what really happens in laws, the laws are vague, and so bureaucratic agencies have to write rules, and nobody reads those. So there's just a lot of information, and none of us have the time to be expert at all of it.
And to get the scope of it even more, that was just the federal level. Then there's state and local, and then courts also, you write. So there's just so much out there, too, now.
Right. You know, in any given year, there are about 350,000 court cases that affect the interpretation of law at every level. And again, you know, there are people who are expert in some areas, but sometimes you hear this idea that, you know, well, we need to be fully informed in order to vote. And if that were the case, no one would be eligible.
Well, no one would have the time. So this isn't a case where we're lazy or uninterested. We may be that too. But even if we were fully active, it would be more than a full-time job to just put a dent in all of this.
Oh, it'd be impossible, even over a lifetime. I mean, it's there are so many, and it's not just knowing facts about the laws. I mean, if you're interested in politics, you want to know how they affect certain people and how they could affect people in the future. And so, you know, thankfully we have people who are experts in some of these areas, but you know, most of us only know the tip of the iceberg in only a few areas.
So, in the absence of this info, how do we make political decisions, like who to vote for?
Well, what's interesting is a lot of the decisions for us in the public are structured. So, you know, we have a Democrat or a Republican, and for a lot of people, they know that they're closer to one of those two parties, and knowing that the candidate is one of those two parties can help them make a good decision. And just for what it's worth, this is not a political thing. When we're out driving and you're at an intersection, you know, an engineer might tell you that you have to know the motivation of every driver and the speed and acceleration of the 50 cars that are at the intersection with you at rush hour if you're in a city. But we don't spend time thinking about any of that. We look at the light, and we look and we see if it's red or if it's green, and we base our decision on that. And in politics, when we have decisions to make, like votes, we want to see if it's red or blue in this case, and then many people vote accordingly.
Talking to Arthur Lupia from the University of Michigan, and his new book is Uninformed. So in the absence, Arthur, of this info, we want to know more, I think most of us. How do we get to a place where we know more and then we can make more informed decisions, whatever those might be?
Yeah, so at one age, we're at the golden age. At one level, we're in the golden age of political information, because if you're a news junkie, there's so much information from so many sources that are available today. So for that type of person, the question is, you know, how much can you get through it all? And most people can't. So at the same time, the technologies that allow that information to be available also introduce a lot of distractions. And so for some people, you know, they'd rather play Candy Crush or watch cat videos. And so, you know, maybe a question for them is, how do you get political information to them? So different people have different needs. But if you're a junkie, you know, this is the best age ever.
You point toward a group of people in this country called civic educators as part of what can make a difference here. First of all, what is a civic educator?
Well, a civic educator, it's a broad term to mean anybody who thinks that there's a group of people who, if they just knew a little bit more about some aspect, could improve quality of lives for themselves or their community or their nation. So it could include teachers, but it could include people who run campaigns. It could include faith leaders or community organizers or whatever. But it's people who want to use the power of information to give people ability to improve their quality of life.
And do we need more of them?
Well, in my book, you know, civic educators are the heroes, you know, people who are trying to do this. I think we need more of them. But I think more importantly, it would be great if the ones that we have that could be more effective. And, you know, a problem, you know, you can have the greatest of intentions and you can be even an expert in a particular area. But if we don't know how to communicate information in ways that our target audiences or prospective learners want to hear, then we just sound like Charlie Brown's mother, or we just sound like somebody who's telling you to eat your spinach. And people don't want very much of that. So the challenge, I think, for civic education is, it'd be great if we had more of them, but it'd be even be better if the ones that we had were more effective.
And this is the core, really, of what you're interested in, how a civic educator, whoever that might be, can convey useful information to the audience that wants and needs it in a way that they can use it. So what do we know about what works for civic education, whether we're talking about in a classroom setting or anywhere else?
Well, the one thing we know is that in terms of the world of information, it's gotten a lot more competitive in our lifetimes and in the last 10 years. So if, you know, we might have this vision of maybe 50 years ago, students sat in a classroom and they were very orderly, and when they were told to learn civics, they did. But the reality, I'm not sure that that really worked that well. But now it's impossible, because the kids have cell phones in their pockets or they have a pad next to them. And if the cat video's there, they're going to watch it. And so the question for us is, how do we find this important information that people can use to change their lives, but convey it in a way that they want to pay attention to it? So the trick is staying true to the underlying knowledge that you're trying to convey, but give it to people in a way that they want to hear it and that they think they can actually use it. And the one sentence explanation of how to do that is to try to give information to people that they can actually use, that they see how it relates to their lives and they say, this is information I want to know more about.
Arthur, I want to take this to a really local level. I mean, we can think about voting for president as one very, as you mentioned, directed decision, choice A or choice B or choices C, D, E, or F, probably on a ballot eventually. But let's say there's a local government issue, a local initiative that the city council is doing, something like that. A lot of people think of the concept of going to a committee meeting or going to the city council meeting and fall asleep immediately just thinking about it. How can a local institution like that share this information in an engaging way that people can take action on?
Well, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. In many local elections, what's really important is that civic leaders, local organizations, could be churches, could be economic organizations, could be neighborhood associations, that they have people who really read the law, who really get into the nooks and crannies, and then find ways to relate to their groups. Here is how this law or this proposal affects us. And so in local elections, when parties are often absent, people look for, you know, whether it's a local civic organization or a school board or something like that, they look for trusted authorities, people who they think have done the work. And if you're in a community and over time you've shown, look, I care about this community and I've given advice in the past and I'm accountable for what they've done, you know, that can be a really powerful civic organization. In many cases, it's a local newspaper, but in some cases it can be the JCs or the local League of Women Voters or something of that nature. But in local campaigns, I mean, I think that's the quickest way to do it. But, you know, if you want just people to be able to do it in their homes, You know, there are all kinds of ways that you can design websites that are not so much about you and your friends, but about the voters. So the last thing I'll say is, you know, one mistake that people, civic educators, make is they think that prospective voters want to hear the civic educator story. But what a voter really wants to hear is the educator telling the voter story. So the question is, how do we take the proposition or whatever it is and tie it to the life and concerns of the voters? And if we can tell that story, people become more interested.
But how do you do that in a way that's neutral or non-biased, too? Because I could see that being a worry if the civic educator is spelling out the impact on people. They might be weighting it in one direction or another.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are some people who want non-biased information. There are some people who actually want biased information. So, you know, for people who want biased information, suppose, again, there's a local measure and it's affecting schools, and you have young children in the schools, and people may have a bias there, right? They may really be interested in what is the effect on, you know, special education or on education up to the fifth grade. And so in a sense, they have that bias and they really want to know a lot about that. And they may gravitate to people who are really knowledgeable about those things. But it can also be important for people who are more agnostic to say, to have people lay out. And the League of Women Voters, I think, over many years has been great at this, taking a local proposition and saying, here are the pros, here are the cons, here are some of the people who are for it, here are some of the people who are against it. And in that way, letting people make decisions for themselves.
We're talking about why we know so little about the laws and policies that shape our lives and how we can know more. Arthur Lupia is with us. He's the author of the new book, Uninformed. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been a civic educator, either in a classroom, maybe a high school, or in a community? What works? What doesn't? Do you wish you knew more about politics, local, state, or national? What would help you learn more? And have you served in local government or on a local committee or task force? What did you learn there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with University of Michigan political scientist Arthur Lupia. He's the author of the book, Uninformed, Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that we should all know more about the laws and policies that affect our lives? What should we do to improve that knowledge base? What would help you learn more? Where do you go to find out more about your local government doings, your local laws, state, federal level? What do you wish you knew more about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Arthur, what do we need to know? You write that it's hard to have, I think you used the phrase, a silver bullet or magic bullet, that these are the things everybody's got to know.
Yeah, so, you know, there are a lot of people who will tell you, here are the four or five facts that you need to know about politics. The problem with that is if you take the four or five things that everybody proposes, it's a list with 1,000 things on it. And if you try and say, okay, well, what are the things that everyone agrees that you should know? There's nothing. So that's the beginning of the issue there. But I, you know, if people are asking me for that type of advice, it's you know what your core concerns are in your community, in your life, and so forth. And while it's popular to focus on the federal government, it's very important. There's a lot of people who can have a big impact on their community and a big impact on local government and things of that nature. And so, you know, I encourage people to learn more about that because, you know, in the presidential election, it's a wonderful thing. It's very important. But 110, 120 million people will cast votes in that, and your vote or mine are unlikely to break a tie. But in your town or community or in your civic association, you know, your vote could really make a difference and affect the lives of people around you. And so if you're thinking about an informational investment, I just encourage people not to overlook the importance of the politics in their immediate community.
The other question related would be, how much do we need to know? I mean, we could read all the minutes, I guess, of the city council meeting and look at the legal rulings and our eyes would glaze over again. And it would be maybe written in a language we don't understand. How much do we need to make an important decision on a locally, say, important issue?
That's a great question, Rob. I mean, and it really depends on the complexity of the decision. So the nice thing about politics for most of us voters is that by the time we get to November, there are effectively two choices, with apologies to the third party folks. But, you know, there's a Democrat and a Republican. And so, you know, even a chimp with a coin gets that right half the time. So the question is trying to figure out which one is better. Also, in like ballot measures or initiatives, you know, the ballot measures themselves can be very complicated. But at the end of the day, the question that is asked to you or me is yes or no on this issue. So we don't necessarily have to know everything about it to press the button that is actually best with respect to our values, our community, or so forth. So it depends on what you're being asked to do. If you're a legislator, if you're a judge and you're writing laws and there's a million different ways you could write it, you need to know a lot more. But as a voter, a lot of times you're being asked to choose the best one out of two options. And so there it's figuring out, again, do you like the green light better, or you know, do you like the red option better or the blue option better? And that's a decision that's a lot like, you know, do you want to go when there's a red light or stop when there's a red light?
If I can be a bit cynical here, do people in authority at whatever level want this much public knowledge? I could see a chain of thought being like, well, I'm an elected official or I'm an appointed bureaucrat. I know this really well. I'm pretty capable of doing this. A lot more public insight means a lot of maybe weird ideas, a lot of criticism. It'd be smoother without all of this public information. Is that a chain of thought you think a lot of people are thinking right now?
I'm not sure. In my job, I get to meet a lot of office holders, a lot of people who work in government. And, you know, I think they get a little bit of a bad rap because the ones that want to be on TV the most are the ones that are kind of they often tend to be extreme in some way. A lot of legislators are very thoughtful. They're trying to deal with different types of pressures and different social interests. And, you know, to the extent that they can get, you know, people who want to engage with them in reasonable decisions, they're often interested in it because they can take some of those things and make the laws more legitimate and sort of more pleasing, or if you will, to a broader set of people. So I think there's a lot of politicians who would like greater engagement. And of course, there are some who just want to shut it all down so that, you know, they can talk.
And another possible response to what you're bringing up here, the idea that our government has so much going on, so many new laws at all levels, court rulings, et cetera, I guess a libertarian response might be, well, yeah, that's, we need less of it. We'd have a better grasp of it if government weren't doing so much.
I think that's an interesting argument, but it's not really an argument about information because, you know, if the private sector isn't making decisions about a certain issue, you're leaving them to the public sector. And so the question is, and it's still a complicated issue, right? So if we don't have laws about topic X, then what this means is people out in the public are still going to be making decisions about it. So I think, you know, if you want to be a libertarian, great. But to argue that, you know, we should have fewer laws because life is complicated. Life is complicated whether you have laws or not. And what laws can do is actually give people focal points to reference and say, oh, okay, this is what all of us are doing. Great. Now we don't have to spend a lot of time fighting about that and figuring it out.
Talking to Arthur Lupia about his book, Uninformed, Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. Do you see people out there now, Arthur, trying to do this, trying to boost civic education in quantity and quality?
Sure. There's a lot of great, and I talk about some of these in the book, there's a lot of really great efforts. I mean, one of the big debates in civic education is whether you teach facts or whether you do things like critical thinking. And that's been going back and forth for at least 100 years in this country. But what's really great is there are people all over the place that are finding innovative ways to integrate both. Like one of the favorite examples I have are people who try to do simulations where they'll bring students or communities in and in a very compact and appealing way say, we're going to make a law today. We're going to look at an issue and all of you are going to be stakeholders for this very short period of time, and we're just going to work through how a law is made. And when people realize the types of compromise that are needed and the types of, you know, precision that you might need to write a law one way rather than another, it can really motivate folks. And I've seen this particularly at schools, like in high schools and in colleges. Instead of reading a book about great men, which of course, you know, is a nice thing to do in school, actually putting people in situations where they are empowered to make decisions. I've had students, I teach classes like this myself, and I've had students who come back 3, 5, 10 years later saying, that was a transformative experience, and it's why I'm involved in politics now.
Let's bring in a caller. We've got Todd on the line in Green Bay. Todd, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Yeah. Sometimes I wish that politics was a little bit more like an all-star wrestling match, because I think if you had people throwing shoes at each other and jumping on tables and diving at each other and punching and things, the public would watch and maybe be a little bit more informed as a result. But, you know, all cynicism aside, I think that we have a lot of problems that are going on just the way the news is reported these days. And it's really easy to gloss people over if you're just talking to them on a level of just simple politics. But when you get into some of the meat of some of these issues, you lose them in a heartbeat. They just, unless they're a news junkie, people have been conditioned to believe that I think the best thing that the Democrats have done is totally brand Republicans as extremists and everything else.
Todd, I want to jump in and get a response from Arthur. Just a minute or so left, Arthur. The media, are there things we could be doing better to boost our civic education?
Yeah, I think so. And thanks, Todd, for asking that question. I mean, in the media, there's, not for public radio, but in the commercial sector, people are just trying to get an audience, and the more outrageous, the better. And that's, part of the Trump phenomenon is obviously having to do with that. And so, I have no trouble with being entertaining. And in fact, I think to compete in this world, you have to be entertaining. But the question is, can you find an entertaining way to convey facts? Can you take really important facts and put them in like stories or narratives or simple examples that resonate with people emotionally such that they want to think about it more? The great thing about what you do and what other people do is you create moments where that can happen. And that really complements the traditional learning that we have in school, because ultimately people become interested in this information if they feel it's important to them and they can see ways to act on it.
Good place to leave it. Arthur, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Arthur Lupia, professor of political science at the University of Michigan. His new book is Uninformed: Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. We're remembering David Bowie throughout the show today. He passed away just a couple days after his 69th birthday and the release of his newest album, which sadly I haven't listened to yet. I'll be doing that soon. We're looking for your Bowie memories and your favorite songs. You can share them right now on the Central Time Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR, and we're going to ask for your calls later on as well, play some more music. For now, we'll go out to the news with my favorite, Life on Mars. This is Central Time.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, but her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools if they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Take a look.